Well, hello everybody and welcome to our Catholic News podcast. Now, we have a really interesting and important topic to talk about today. We're going to talk about care at the end of life, and in particular in rather difficult circumstances. And I'm very pleased to say I'm joined by Matt Parks, and Matt's going to be speaking to us because he was 37 when Jeff, his dad, told him he was actually suicidal, and it transpired he had a neurodegenerative condition, but we'll come on to that. So, Matt, thank you for joining us, and thank you for sharing Jeff's story.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Now, you called Jeff Pa, and I thought, oh, that's rather old-fashioned, but yeah. Tell us a bit about Jeff, and tell us a bit about your relationship with him.
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, Jeff, my dad, loved Western movies. So Clint Eastwood, any basically spaghetti Western. And there's one of them called The Outlaw Josie Wales, which I can recommend if anyone's not seen it. And in there, there's a particular scene where a young kid has been shot, and he ends up helping Josie Wales, who's Clint Eastwood's character. He ends up helping Josie Wales. And at one point, he tricks the bad guys by appearing to be confused. And he says, "Pa, is that you, Pa?" So anyway, and that was one of my dad's favourite films. So after that, I started calling him Pa. So it sounds very posh, but it's not.
But it's actually quite charming.
It's based on a Western movie, yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, that strong opening comment I made about him being actively suicidal, how did he come to be in that state of mind?
Yeah, well, I would describe him as an extremely independent character in the sense that, you know, my sister and I had quite a difficult childhood. He wasn't around very much. And he and my mum had had a difficult time. And so their relationship had really sort of broken down. And my dad ended up leaving the house. It was especially difficult because they didn't divorce and completely separate. He would come back every now and again. So it was very, very confusing for us as children, kind of very unpredictable. But at one point, you know, one of the jobs that he had was he worked in the Middle East, actually for a construction machine manufacturer like Caterpillar or JCB, that kind of thing. Yeah. And he would sort of tell these stories of being in Iraq. It was actually during the Iran-Iraq war when he was part of the time when he was there. And, you know, just some of the crazy things he did. He had a bet with a friend that he could swim across the Euphrates River and end up in one of Saddam Hussein's palaces, which you could see from across the river. And he did, and he won the bet because he did swim across. And he got in trouble with the guards when they found him. But, you know, they told him not to try it again and then went off. But so he was just a very independent, very strong-willed character who would kind of achieve things, you know, that he set his mind to. And because of that sort of determination, I think when in 2011, when he was 63, his eyesight, he had suffered with glaucoma for about 10 or 15 years. He'd picked it up very late, so it was quite advanced. So that was having an effect on his eyesight. Mm. But the problem was that he was then beginning to lose his balance as well, and he was falling. And he knew that something really serious was going on, but he didn't really talk to very many people about it at all. And then 2011, I can't remember now exactly where we were or how he did it, but he took me aside and he said, "Listen, son," or "Listen, boy," in fact, as he used to call me, because it was like from the Western movies, "Listen, boy." And his phrase was, "Some people are long lifers, some people are short lifers. I think I'm a short lifer." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, something's going on. I don't know what it is, but I don't want to be around. So, you know, I don't want to let this happen to me. Whatever it is, I don't want to let it happen. I can't bear the thought of this." And he'd obviously given it, even by then, he'd given it a lot of thought. Intellectually, he was always a very active, very well-read kind of character. And he'd really thought in great detail about this and looked into it.
But no diagnosis at this point?
No diagnosis.
Right.
So yeah, 2011, he was determined. I mean, he was really determined to end his life. And he said to me, "I need you to help me." And I said, "Well, I'm sorry, but I can't do that." Now, I explained. He didn't have a faith. I'm a Catholic. And I explained to him, I said, "Listen, I know you're going to disagree with me as soon as I say this, but I can't collude in that. I can't assist in that." And we debated it, quite a heated debate, because he really strongly disagreed with it. And he'd go into quite detailed thinking about how he would do it and everything. And for about 6 months, it was very difficult because he would speak to me quite often about it. And I would try and encourage him to get additional help or speak to people, other people, professionals about it, his doctors. But he didn't really want any of that interference as he saw it. So, yeah, that was a really, really tough time, but I actually helped him to come through it. It was having quite an effect on me, actually, and eventually, in fact, as it happens, my wife wrote to him and said, "You know, can you stop talking to Matt about this in this way? Because it's having a really big impact on him." so it was interesting because that, I think, combined then with the conversations that he and I were having, began to sort of shift him a little bit. But if you sort of fast forward 2 years, we were at an ophthalmology appointment. By this point, before this point, it was clear that something very, very difficult was happening to him, although we didn't know what. We tried to find out what was going on. And he had looked into things like lasting power of attorney and things like that. So he said to me, son, I want you to have the decisions. So we set up a lasting power of attorney for financial things and also lasting power of attorney for health and welfare, I think it's called. So I had those things in place before 2013. But it was actually, we were at an appointment with an ophthalmologist. And he looked at my dad. He'd never met my dad before, but he looked at him and just the way he was sort of stooping over. And he said, has he been seen by a neurologist? Because I've spent time in neurology and my instinct is that just looking at him, there's something neurological happening. And so that began a really helpful, if distressing, journey towards discovering what was going on. So he was eventually in 2014, he was diagnosed with this condition called PSP, which stands for progressive supranuclear palsy, which is it's a very rare condition. It's kind of like a mix between Parkinson's disease and motor neuron disease, something like that. So it's neurodegenerative because of the part of the brain that it starts to affect first. It very commonly affects eyesight first. But one of its really characteristic features is very, very unusually, people who have that condition fall backwards when they lose their balance. I think it's one of only two conditions where that happens. So because he was very proud, a very independent kind of character, to be falling in public was very, very hard for him. So despite everything then that I was trying to set up for him and arrange for him, he would still find it very difficult.
So at that point, when he's had that diagnosis, he's clearly an intelligent man, a clever man that knows his own mind, as we've learned from the stories, and wants to control what happens at the end of life.
Yeah.
Is he still actively suicidal at that point? Is he still wanting that?
Yeah, I mean, he would, to be honest, he rarely spoke about it, certainly in the really graphic ways that he did back in 2011. You know, when I had to resort to very dark humour to try and sort of, you know, deflect some of the things he was saying. But essentially, it was clear that he was still suicidal. His preference was to end his life. He said to me, you know, these are his words that he said to me. He said, son, listen, I don't want to be a vegetable. I'd never want to have a tube fitted, like a feeding tube or something like that, or an oxygen mask. I never want anything like that to happen to me. Things like Dignitas, the clinic in Switzerland, you know, that was known about then. That was he'd looked into that. He'd considered that quite seriously. He wanted me to go out there with him and take him over there. And lots of other ideas that he'd had about how he could end his life. You know, and I explained to him the limits within which I would work. I sought out really helpful guidance, which I managed to get, which enabled me to sort of understand what were the limits, if you like. How far could I go in helping him and still remain true to the spirit of what church teaching was? And what's really amazing, actually, the journey of discovery that I then went on was that church teaching is really beautiful. It's really focused on the individual. It's really focused on their dignity. It's really focused on their quality of life. It's really focused on their happiness. It's really focused on their wishes. For me, it was a really positive, very, very positive experience of sort of seeing all of that come to life. Now, I then had to have very real conversations with him about, so what do you want to happen if this happens, or how far along this road would you like to go? But as it happened then, his condition sort of got worse and worse. So in 2015, I left the job that I was doing then. I was working part-time and I was spending the rest of the time as his primary carer, even though he was actually living at home independently. Although, for example, I had one of those buttons that you can press to call to call for assistance. And he just did not want to wear it. So he didn't want to wear it around his neck. I tried to get it a wristband and he put it on his wrist. The best I could get him to do was put it into his dressing gown pocket. But it took me a long time to try to persuade him not to be walking up the stairs carrying a mug of tea, for example, which he did one time and fell backwards all the way back down the stairs, I later discovered. And sure enough, the button was in his pocket, you know, so he managed eventually to get himself up, but, you know, he couldn't call for help. So there were really difficult things. And I think, if you fast forward to the end, so he passed away in 2017. So it's actually, it was a total journey of about 6 years. You know, those 6 years culminated with him having in place, it was something which I'd heard of, and I thought de facto was not allowed to happen, if you like, within church teaching. So I didn't think this was going to be possible to do this. It was something called an advanced decision, which is a document in which his wishes are expressed really clearly.
Legally?
Legally, yeah. So it's a legal document which is witnessed by two independent witnesses. Now, interestingly, that journey, we initially had something which was called something like an advanced statement of care wishes and preferences. In the end, the advanced decision was nothing more, actually, than saying, you know, in a sense, in a nutshell, I don't want to be kept alive indefinitely. I don't want to be just resuscitated for the sake of resuscitated. I don't want to receive treatment, whether that's clinical feeding or other treatments, just solely to keep my life going indefinitely. And that was in the context of suffering. So I was able to sort of explain to him, you know, right at the beginning, Pai, you said to me two things. One is you didn't want to be a vegetable. Fundamentally, that was his biggest fear, that he didn't want to get to that point. And I guess what did he mean by that? Well, I didn't ask him this back in 2011, but had I asked him, I think what he would have said is, I don't want to be in a situation where I can't walk, I can't move, I can't see, I can't hear properly, I can't write or communicate, I can't speak, I can't physically feed myself, I can't, you know, that those sorts of things. I mean, if, you know, I can't change myself, I can't wash myself. Those things, I think, would have been the definition for him, which for anybody, really understandably, I think anybody, I would think that, you know, now. Exactly the same sort of list of things that I wouldn't want to happen to me either. And understandably, you know, anybody wouldn't want those things. Very, very understandably. But actually what I saw come to life by going through this process was that there are ways of, you know, being able to put in this document that, first of all, you know, I want my son, who has lasting power of attorney for health and welfare, I want him to be able to make the decisions. So I have entrusted the decision to him to make. But if for some reason I wasn't there, it could have been his neighbour or a friend or a doctor who could have recorded the things which I recorded. I recorded them in a document, which anyone could have recorded actually in a document. But it's things like, for example, there's a form that you can fill in which is called a DNAR, Do Not Attempt Resuscitation. And one of the bits of it I've got written down here, and it said he wanted the situation. He said that any distressing symptoms, including any caused by an inability to eat or drink, are fully controlled by appropriate pain relief or other treatment, even though that treatment may shorten my life.
Yeah.
So the point of it was, the intention wasn't to shorten his life. The intention was to reduce his suffering. And there's another bit which I read the other day when I was just thinking about all of this, which struck me as being really, really interesting. It said, I remember clearly I came up with the words of this, but all of it, I read out all of this to him. He couldn't, by the end, as I'll say a bit more in a moment, but he couldn't see by this point because of the way that the condition had advanced. He'd completely lost his sight. But I read it out to him, and then the document that he signed was witnessed by two independent witnesses, and they signed so that they could, and it was read out by one of his carers, so the witnesses could see that he was giving his consent to everything that was written in this document.
And one point to make at this stage, because you explained right back in 2011, you know, before a diagnosis, that he's, you know, although you didn't agree with it, he was making his wishes known to you. You knew from your particular faith perspective you couldn't collude with that. That wasn't going to work for you, obviously. So what I want to get at is that it does seem to me, though, that he did make himself clear every step of the way, and hence the documents that you ended up with that were legally binding were basically his views. They were negotiated in terms of, you made it clear what you could do and he made it clear what he wanted. But just to be clear, what you ended up with was what your dad wanted.
Yeah, every step of the way. So, for example, there's this bit and it says, in the context of good palliative care, I would like to receive nutrition and fluids by feeding tube, such as a peg or a rig, unless or until the benefits of that are considered to be outweighed by the burden on me. What was really fascinating was, you know, I said at the very beginning, he said to me, I don't want to be a vegetable, son, and I don't want a feeding tube. That was, I think he might have seen one or something. That was in his head. He actually mentioned it to me explicitly.
Yeah.
Now, in the final year of his life, he had to, because of the complexities of the condition and the multiple things that it was affecting, for example, that you needed to put eye drops into his eyes every hour because of they weren't producing tears in the right way. So it was a very, very intensive care routine at the end. For the final year, he was receiving that sort of care at home. And about 3 months before, I think it was about 3 or 4 months before he ended up dying, he was in a condition where he couldn't walk or move by himself any longer. He couldn't make it to the shower any longer by himself. He couldn't go to the toilet by himself. He needed manual handling to get in and out of chairs. He couldn't see anything. He could hear, but not very well. He couldn't speak any longer. And for somebody who used to be able to speak extremely persuasively, to put it mildly, that was very difficult for him. But he, and I've got a funny story I must tell you in a moment about his, in a sense, bringing this person to life, even though there are these limitations.
Those limitations, yeah.
But towards that end, so about 3 or 4 months before the end, you know, I should say, by the way, that through this whole thing, the relationship with my mum had been difficult for a long time. Mm. And as his illness progressed, there was actually a reconciliation between them towards the end. So she would then come up to his house and would stay, and the carers were there 24 hours a day, but she would come up and stay in a spare room as well and be there a lot of the time with him for long months, several months at a time.
How did you feel about that? Was that something that you would have previously thought inconceivable?
Inconceivable. Completely inconceivable.
It's quite something on your mum's part as well, isn't it?
Obviously. It is, yeah, remarkable. I mean, you know, if you've ever seen two cats caterwauling at each other where they're kind of and they've got their claws out and, you know, they're sort of, their ears are flattened down on their head. That was a bit like that.
A bit of circling.
That was, yeah, exactly. And then and then the fur would fly. You know, that was them. Even during the early periods of the illness when he was suicidal, my mum didn't know about that, the extent of that. Mm. You know, and through the very, very difficult times early on, there wasn't, you know, very much relationship there, if you like. But what ended up happening is within the last year, maybe in the last 18 months of his life, that relationship with my mum was essentially reconciled.
Yeah.
And also my sister, who I think, you know, with the difficult times that we'd had when we were growing up and him being away a lot of the time, she studied languages and then went off to work abroad. And for all of her life, she worked abroad. So I hadn't seen that much of him. And then as he got ill, she started to see more of him. And I often reflected, you know, if at the time back in 2011, he'd done what he wanted to do. And it wasn't just an idle thought, as I say, he was actively suicidal.
Yeah.
But I knew, I could tell by his voice, he was very serious about it. It was a really, really difficult time. You know, if he'd gone ahead with that, or Dignitas, or, you know, whichever route he'd eventually worked out a way of doing, you know, what would have happened was that reconciliation, for example, with my mum would never have happened. The relationship that was then sort of finally almost rebuilt and really deepened with my sister wouldn't have happened. And my dad, he liked Western movies, but he also liked books. So Louis L'Amour was one of his, you know, he liked lots of reading. He'd read The Economist and The Financial Times and The Sun, all open at the same time. He'd sort of read, and that was his sort of daily papers. And then the next day, it'd be a completely different mix. He'd just constantly consuming. And then it would be The Mirror the next day with The Spectator. You know, he saw things in lots of different ways. But he also loved these Western books. So Louis L'Amour was one of his favourite authors. But my sister, you know, would sit with him even in the very, very end, right at the very end. You know, she would sit with him in the hospital eventually when he died, holding his hand and reading Louis L'Amour. Even though he could no longer speak by that point, he had to raise a voice so that he could hear. But he was able to give indication with a sound that he was able to hear her, and A, able to hear her, and B, wanted her to continue reading. So he was able to enjoy this sort of experience right the way till the end. But coming back to the feeding tube thing, it was remarkable because 3 or 4 months before what would turn out to be the end, I mean, obviously you don't know how long the end is going to be
by this point. Yeah.
But I said to him, because he could really no longer eat properly, he wasn't able to swallow, he wasn't able to chew food, he was choking a lot because the muscles in his throat controlling swallowing had stopped working. So even small sips of drink would get stuck in his throat. And it was very, you know, so, and there was always a big risk of pneumonia and infections and things like that. So the decision to use a feeding tube was then discussed. Now, given that that was one of the things he'd explicitly said he never wanted to happen, it was a red light, precisely. Yeah. And I said to him, so, Pa, what do you want to do? And I waited. My mum and my sister weren't around. Had a one-to-one with him, and if you like, and just was very, very direct with him about it all. And I said, you said you didn't want this. I'm giving you permission now to say, I don't want this. And that's it, we won't do it. This is one of the things you've said you don't want to do because of the suffering, the distress that it could cause you. So if that's what you want, I told you I would honour your wishes, even though I didn't want that to happen, you know, in a sense. But I mean, I didn't say that to him, but I just said, you know, what do you want to do?
Yeah.
I said, I'd do that. And he indicated, clearly, he was able to just about form words at that point, a little, but he was able to indicate very, very clearly that he wanted to go ahead with the feeding tube. But he was also quite concerned about something. I couldn't quite hear what he was saying. By that point, it was very hard to make out the syllables as he was speaking. But he sort of said, it was obviously he was concerned about something. And I said to him, do you want me to read the document again that we put together and that expresses your wishes really clearly? And so, as I say, that bit in there that I read out earlier on, you know, in the context of good palliative care, I would like to receive nutrition by fluids and feeding tubes. I wrote this bit on his behalf after this conversation. Unless or until the benefits of that are considered to be outweighed by the burden on me. So, and he was happy with that. He gave his consent at that point to do that. Yeah. Now, he then lived for another nearly 4 months from that point. And that was remarkable. That was really amazing, because in those 3 months even, there were things that happened, conversations that he and my mum had, things that my sister was able to say to him that she hadn't been able to.
For her sake as well as his, I presume.
Yeah, precisely. And I was chatting with her about it, just reminiscing, and she said it was such a precious, such a unique time. It was so rich. It was such a blessing. You know, there was such a connection that was able to be made there. He actually died, in the end, holding her hand. And she was reading to him. She was reading a Louis L'Amour. And that's when he died. And so even though it was completely different from his previous life, even though it was actually, if you were to look at it, if I showed him a video of himself in that hospital bed at the end, and I said, you know, back in 2011, if I'd showed it to him, if I'd put it onto his big TV where he watched his Westerns, let's just look at you in 6 years' time. This is going to be you. Honestly, he would have, at that point, that would have confirmed his fears and distress. Yeah. But in fact, all the way through, right the way through that final year, I kept checking with him, are you okay? Are you happy with this? Is this being done in the way that you wanted?
And you gave him permission to go another way, within the construct of what you believe in,
yeah,
of course.
Exactly. But also this man, this kind of humour of this man would be there. Well, it wasn't humour. I think he was actually very serious about this. But I said that he couldn't see, he couldn't speak. So how do you make yourself understood at that point? There's lots of technology that you can use. Mm. You know, now there's lots of technology for recording your voice in advance. And then AI can generate it and use it to generate your voice saying things. If somebody else is going through this sort of situation, you know, then try and record your voice as early as possible. And then
good thinking.
That might that's an option. But in the end, for him, because of the cognitive impairment that was starting to happen as well. So with PSP, you begin to get a cognitive impairment. He wasn't really able to learn new skills. And so technology, even like a touchscreen device or anything very complicated, anything that required memory or things like that was very hard. So in the end, I found a board that was a communication board that you could program individual buttons. So it had about 30 or so buttons on it. And using foam, you know, I just ordered from a sort of a child's toy shop, you know, the sort of
arts
foam,
and craft.
Yeah, arts and craft sort of thing. Foam letters, quite big foam letters in multiple colours, but he couldn't see the colours. But I stuck one of those on it, and it was the alphabet, and I stuck them onto these buttons. And then I recorded my voice, and I thought, it's going to get so confusing. His hearing isn't very good, and he's trying to communicate to people who may not really get what he's trying to say. So I actually used the phonetic alphabet. So this board, and I've still got it somewhere where if I put the batteries back in it and press the buttons, it would say A for Alpha, B for Bravo, C for Charlie, D for Delta,
clever.
All the way through the
simple
alphabet.
But clever.
I think this was maybe about 4 or 5 months before he died. So again, he couldn't see properly. Things were you would think from the outside to see him if you hadn't been there for any of the journey and you just met him for the first time, and you think, gosh, this man's really suffering. This is awful. Actually, you know, his carer said to him one day, Jeff, what do you want for dinner? Now, there's a brilliant company called Wiltshire Farm Foods, and they deliver various degrees of pureed food reconstituted into the sort of pattern to make it look like the meal, like, you know, roast beef and then...
But without the duress of chopping it up.
Exactly, and it's all pureed and it's really nice. Yeah. And the taste is, I mean, that's what the food is. It's just been pureed and then put into these piles on the plate. So it's they're actually pretty good, I can tell you. So
tried one?
Yeah, I have tried one, yes. But there was only a relative... I mean, you know, if you're having them all the time, there's only a relatively limited selection. But one time the carer said to him, you know, Jeff, what would you like for lunch? And he sort of waved his hand, which was his indication that he wanted the communication board. And bless his carer, because I heard about this afterwards. I wasn't there those days. I spoke to her afterwards, and she said to me, Matt, listen, I have to tell you it was quite hard, but it took about 30 minutes for me. And I sat there with a notepad, and it took him 30 minutes to get it out. But he spelt, bearing in mind you have the phonetic alphabet, etc., and he spelt out Hungarian beef goulash. Which,
no wonder it took half an hour.
Exactly. And as it turns out, they don't have that on the menu. So...
Oh.
my lovely wife then actually, I told her about it that week, and we were going up to see him at the weekend. So she actually made him some Hungarian beef goulash, and then we pureed it and everything. And he was able to have it. So, you know, the fact that if you'd have said to me beef goulash, I'm not sure I would have known it was from Hungary. But he was quite specific. It was Hungarian beef goulash he wanted.
And that, I don't know him, didn't know him, but that sounds like your dad.
Exactly.
Would I be right?
Exactly, yeah. Precisely that. Precisely.
Quite representative of his character, which is something you don't lose, isn't it? It's there.
It's there inside. And what was amazing and what was really, I think, really powerful was that we were able to honour that, to respect his dignity, to respect his choices, to honour the things that he had said that he wanted to avoid happening. You know, he knew that he'd got through this document and the sort of various safeguards that we'd thought about, even though he and I had our differences, as I've said, about what he would have wanted to happen versus what I said I would be prepared to actually help him with. You know, he was able to live, certainly from that initial point of being actively suicidal, yeah. You know, he lived a further 6 years, even from the point of having this very difficult diagnosis in 2014, and in a sense, this sort of physical and bodily decline and happened sort of relatively quickly from that point. You know, for 2015, 16, 17 were hard. But strangely, his quality of life increased. In fact, when we got to the end and he was in the hospital because he had sepsis, so he went into hospital for that to be treated. And in fact, specifically in his advanced decision document, he said he didn't want to go into hospital. He wanted to die at home. Mm. But when he was very unwell, but we managed to ask him if he wanted to go into hospital to be treated, if they could treat the sepsis. If they couldn't, then it wouldn't continue beyond that. But would you like them to try to get this better? And he was able to indicate with a verbal noise that was clearly a positive agreement noise. That's what he wanted. But yeah, so in that week, there were various things that they were trying to do to help him. But various measures that they were able to take, where they were looking at his, you know, as you know, in hospital at that point, at the end of life, they take lots of measurements, blood oxygen and various other things. Yeah. They push on the skin, for example, to see the health of the tissues and things. The doctors at the time, you know, said that they were particularly struck by how healthy his body was, even though it was clearly at the end of his life. He said this man has had such care, such nutrition. They particularly mentioned the sort of nutrition levels. You know, I think the Hungarian beef goulash obviously played a part in it.
Might have pepped him up.
Probably pepped him up, exactly. But, you know, through that feeding tube, you know, things like that.
Mm.
So even though that brought him to the end of his life, and that was really amazing, you know, and again, for me to sort of see it very vividly, that his wishes were completely honoured right the way through to the end. So one of the things he said, I don't want to be kept alive just unnecessarily. I don't want to have unnecessary suffering. And I effectively control the symptoms, even if that brings about the end of my life.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. So what we increased, that it was, I think he was on morphine and there were one or two other things as well, but the morphine was just slightly increased and then it appeared that his breathing was becoming more difficult. There was a risk of that becoming distressing for him. You could see a little bit that he was having to labour a bit with his breathing. And so they just increased it a little bit more and a little bit more. And eventually that was it. He was in a very, very peaceful state. So, you know, I've spoken subsequently to friends. You know, there's our local priest who says, you know, he, in the middle of the night, sometimes if people are dying in the local hospital and they don't have any family, don't have any friends, and the doctors will say, is there anyone you'd like us to call? And sometimes, whether they're a believer or not, you know, if a churchgoer or not, sometimes they'll say, can you get a priest? So sometimes this man, he's been priest in ministry for 25 years, and he said, you know, I've been at the bedside of hundreds of people over the years who've died with me holding their hands. Because I was explaining that some of what had happened. He said, I've never in that time seen somebody dying in uncontrollable pain or uncontrollable distress. You know, it's that I've never witnessed that. You know, and it's not to say clearly that it never happens, but
no.
I think that's the point of what I've learned through this whole process was, you know, with that care, on really good palliative care, that's what sort of, if you like, came out to me at the end, that it is possible to give somebody a quality of life that was very different from what they would have wanted in one sense, you know, if you look back. But by the end, and the family relation, the quality of family relationships and things like that, he was able to have.
That's the bit I find extraordinary, actually, if I'm honest, because you say his body was sort of, all things considered, relatively healthy at the end. But even when your body is failing, your mind is failing, your body is failing, to have that time, to have what might not be very easy encounters, even if we don't call them conversations. Because, when my brother was dying at the very end, words weren't spoken, but I felt I knew what was going on. You do, don't you? You feel, yeah, you know what's going on. Yeah. It's just a very valuable, healthy time that you can have with family members when things haven't perhaps been perfect over the years, whose situation is really. And the thought of not having that time almost fills you with more distress, doesn't it, than anything else.
And for him, in a sense, the things that he was able to enjoy, there were movies that he was watching, because he did like going to cinema, so films was part of the range of things that he enjoyed. I'm trying to think of specifics now of films that he was able to watch, even when he could no longer see the screen very clearly. But he was able to listen and get a really good picture of it. And there were, silly action films and things like that. But and there was a sequel to the first one. And he wouldn't have got to see the sequel or hear the sequel.
He liked The Mirror and he liked The Economist in one breath, he probably liked Die Hard and Citizen Kane, I'm sure.
That's more or less exactly it, to be honest with you. Both of those were on his list of top movies. So but he had those. And then at a human level, that connection, the reconciliation,
yeah,
as I say, the reconciliation with his wife. I took some photos the day before he died of my mum holding his hand. And that was something my sister and I looked at it afterwards and thought, when we were little, when we were little children, we wouldn't have ever envisaged that, seeing that. But to see that in that way, sat there holding hands and it was obviously distressing. I mean, it was sad and it was distressing for everybody. And yet there was something so beautiful and can't be taken away. The experiences that my sister had as well, it was able to, something was able to be filled
eased
in
a bit potentially.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm so moved by this, Matt, and I really appreciate you coming in and talking about Jeff, but also talking about your mum and your sister on a very hard journey for everyone.
Yeah.
But what a time at the end there. What a wonderful period of time to have. But the one thing that strikes me as well on top of this is that you were very careful. You were careful to make sure that, just as a testament to your dad as a person, as a character, with all he stood for, that he should have his own way where you could do so. And it does seem to be an agreement, a very mutual agreement between you. But also you were creative with his care. So that care at the end of life, family members can be creative with the care. I mean, that device you talked to me about, I saw a picture. It's like a giant speak and spell with felt buttons, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very creative. But it was designed to still give him a voice when he no longer had one.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's amazing as far as I'm concerned. You can be creative with the care. You can find a way with care.
Yeah.
I know there are very extreme exceptions, of course. But at the same time, this is your story. This is what you did. And you worked very hard at it. I'm very moved by it.
Yeah. No, thank you. It was a really tough journey. I mean, I think, this is a particular phrase, if you like, that I've heard that comes to my mind, given my faith perspective. But heroic suffering that he ended up giving. I mean, he gave something very concrete. What he gave us, let's say that. Well, he gave certainly my mum and my sister. At one level, it cost him.
Yeah,
dearly to do it. It was a really heroic thing. But it was just an incredible gift. Wishing to prevent other people's suffering by not letting them see you get more and more ill or more and more distressed or more and more in pain. Again, I totally understand that and I really appreciate why that might happen. But I think for him, if that had happened, compared to where things ended up, their distress would have been 10 times more if he had taken his own life. And certainly, where it ended up was remarkable.
Well, Matt Parks, thank you so much for joining us and telling us the story of care at the end of life. Very special, I have to say. Not without its huge difficulties along the way. And as you say, it does sound like Jeff gave a lot during that time and cost him quite a lot too.
Yeah.
But you all gave as well. It, what an exchange. The reconciliation between your mum, your sister and him, I find truly moving. Not every situation works out like that, but good on you. Good effort. And I'm delighted to hear that.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for your time, Matt.
Thank you.